First, I want to thank Stephen for his prayer on my behalf. Sometimes I need all the help I can get. Seems like my meter's a little faster than some people's, and especially if I've had too many cookies on Sunday morning or whatever, so sugar high and hyper. Our lesson for this morning is from Hebrews, the 5th chapter. I already talked to Greg about this. I guess I'm going to have to start posting what I'm going to do like ahead of time. Yeah. But unfortunately, it's like putting one signpost in the middle of the desert. It's like a big magnet. You know, if you've ever seen them, you know, they're always hit by somebody. So, anyway, let's get into the serious stuff. In Hebrews, to give you kind of an overview of what we're getting into, the book of Hebrews is written, in essence, for the most part, two-thirds of it, before Paul gets into practical application, or the Hebrew writer does, of making an argument of the superiority of the new covenant over the old Mosaic law. And so he goes through chapter by chapter, showing, you know, in various ways that it is superior. And when he gets to chapter 5, it's an introduction into the high priesthood. And this is important and significant. In fact, this chapter, as we're looking into it, as you know, Greg kind of incorporated in the Lord's Supper, actually, you know, speaks more of what Christ's purpose was than to celebrate this time of year of just his birth. It's the beginning of something special, but chapter 5 of Hebrews is the culmination of something special. Now, the Jews would appreciate this, the Jewish Christians that the author is writing to, because at the time of the Jews in the first century, their high priests, Ananias and Caiaphas, were not really legitimate high priests. Their position was bought first from the Assyrians, who were their overlords, and then from the Romans. Just certain individuals offer them, hey, you make us high priest and we'll give you so much of the coffers of the temple. So it was a bought position. Now, when the writer here, the author here of Hebrews 5, talks about the high priest, he's going back to the old high priest order, the legitimacy of it. And he's not taking anything away from it. In fact, if you look at it, he's really building it up to make it all it was meant to be by God. But when he does that, he also even then more elevates the high priest of the Lord. So it begins in verse 1, where he says about, you know, it gets into kind of qualifications too, where it says, every high priest is taken from among men. Okay. Or is appointed and taken from among men. That word appointed there is significant. And appointed on behalf of men, things concerning God, that he, in order, they might offer gifts, offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. So this is what his purpose was. Is first of all, there's an identification with a people. And that's significant as to, you know, the qualifications for Christ's high priesthood. Next he goes, and when he talks about gifts and sacrifices, this really does hark back to the olden times where the high priest, and probably were thinking more of the Day of Atonement because of some of the things that are said, where the high priest is offering up gifts to God for the people. Back then it would have been the incense that was offered in the temple or tabernacle service primarily. And the New Testament's related in the book of Hebrews to the prayers of the saints going up, and also the sacrifice for sins. And that's significant because of the second thing that kind of gets into, says he can deal gently then, you know, with the ignorant and the misguided, since he himself is beset with weaknesses. So he's not a high priest in the sense of that he lords it over the people, doesn't look down on them as they're bringing their sacrifices and he's looking at their sins, you know, whatever. There's incorporated in this a certain kind of gentleness as the way God, you know, structured it. Because the high priest being a man also had the sins and probably didn't have every sin that everybody else had, but he could sympathize that there is something that you know, we all have that kind of overcomes us at times or overwhelms us. And the high priest, being human, also, you know, went through these things. In fact, if you know the history of some of the high priests, you know how much trouble they got into at times. But, you know, think purely of the high priest. You know, even the best of them was beset with weaknesses. And because of that weakness, could understand, you know, the weaknesses that the people had. Therefore, he could deal gently with them. And this was something that was important because it wasn't just, you know, taking the sacrifice. You know, it's listening to the sins, helping them out, kind of counseling them also. And knowing, you know, kind of how he would overcome things, you know, he could help them. Now, as it goes on, it says, and because of it, that weakness, okay, he is obliged to offer sacrifices. Now, how is he obliged to do this? Is because, or obligated, in the sense that, well, what the high priest did on the Day of Atonement was first offer up a sacrifice for himself, okay, for his own sins. Okay, so it gets into, as for the people, their sins, but also, you know, for himself. So he's not pure. He has to make himself pure first as a high priest and right with God before he can really properly do the office that he officiates at. And so here, the Hebrew writer is building this up as, you know, this is a very unique individual, or should be. Okay. Now, as it gets in there, in contrast, what the Hebrew writer's already done in Hebrews 4:15, where he talks about, and I don't know why the translators put this in a double negative, you know, when he goes, for we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses. I don't know why they don't just go, we have a high priest who can sympathize with our weaknesses. You know, to weed it straight, okay? But, you know, he's one that has been tempted in all things as we are. Now, the one there, the translators, you know, capitalize it because it's referring to Christ, also as a high priest. Okay? So he did have to suffer. You know, he had to undergo the temptations in this world, okay, just as other high priests did, so that he could also sympathize with the people. But there's a significant, the last line that's added here in the fourth chapter is which makes him different than the other high priests. Now, he went through all the temptations. He knows, you know, what they have to face. But with Christ, what's unique about him is he knew how to overcome them. I mean, that's the first thing we're introduced to is Jesus in the wilderness being tempted by Satan. And he shows us how to handle any kind of temptation that comes. In fact, if you've ever been to an AA meeting or something like that, you realize that a lot of people that sponsor these things are addicts that have already been through the problem and through the process. And they sympathize and they know best how to deal with people. First of all, they know when someone's lying to them because they fully understand. But they also know, okay, I've and usually with an addict or someone with a problem, they have to hit rock bottom first. So they've gone all the way and know how to work slowly out of that. And Jesus knows how to do that. Okay? He's been through temptations. In fact, where we might have one or other, he went through them all and knows exactly how to deal with each one of us. So he's the best counselor to go to in some circumstances, especially since he is without sin. He did overcome every one of them. So that makes him unique and superior to other high priests. Then as it goes on, and as the high priest, you know, this is like another major qualification, so no one takes the honor for himself. Okay, now, this is what disqualified the Caiaphas and Ananias. You know, they did take the honor for themselves, so they really weren't high priests. But notice it says the real legitimate high priest receives it. He receives this honor when he's called by God. So what made a high priest legitimate in the Old Testament was God called him, starting with Aaron, you know, as Aaron was. Okay? Aaron didn't come up and go, hey, I want to be the high priest. You know, or I'm Moses' brother. I'm vastly qualified. No, God was looking at other qualifications. Okay. And so Aaron was called, and every high priest after, every legitimate high priest, has this qualification part of it. Okay, so qualifications for a high priest, he has to identify with his fellows. So Jesus had to be a man. This is what Hebrews 2 gets into. He had to be made lower than the angels. He had to take on the form of a man, Philippians 2. He had to be like us in just about every way to sympathize with us, to understand us, okay, in order to qualify. And then he had to be called by God. You know, he just didn't automatically go, well, okay, I'm the Son of God, therefore I'm the high priest. Yeah, no, it needed the Father to call him to that. Okay? And so this is what he gets into. So also Christ did not glorify himself. Now notice the change. Before, we're talking about a high priest, you know, receiving the honor or trying to take the honor. Okay? Now he's using a different word, a more important word, glorify. Because as a high priest, this high priest that's different than the Aaron high priest is going to be standing by the right hand of God in heaven. So it's a full glorification. And Christ didn't even take that for himself. Rather, it goes, but he who said to him, thou art my son, today have I begotten you. That's the beginning part of it. And that's from Psalms 2, where, look here, it goes, Psalms 2, 6 through 7. But as for me, I have installed my king in Zion, my holy mountain. I will surely tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, thou art my son, today have I begotten you. This is a messianic psalm. Every Jewish Christian recognized this. So as the Messiah, in fact, you know, as it starts here, it goes, Christ did not glorify himself. That word Christ, Greek, Christos, is the same as the Messiah in Hebrew. So the Messiah did not take this glory to himself. Although he was, you know, prophesied to be, you know, the Messiah and a king, that's what was understood that the Messiah would be. He would come and sit on the throne of David, and he would rule his kingdom. But the Hebrew writer adds more to it. You know, just as he also said in another passage, thou art a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Now at this point, it gets overwhelming for the Jewish mind. Because he's pointing out something perhaps they didn't think. They knew the passages. Probably all of them could quote these things. But the significance of what the Hebrew writer is bringing out is now something that's going to, you know, blow the old priesthood away. Because yeah. Now he goes to Psalms 110, which Justin read, part of this context. So the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind, thou art a priest forever. See, the problem with the Aaronic priesthood is that the guy was human, and he died. Okay? And so he had to be replaced. There was a whole procession of high priests, some good, some bad. But now this high priest is going to be appointed, and God's going to swear in his appointment, as it's forever, according to this order of Melchizedek. And when he talks about the order of Melchizedek, you know, this is from Genesis, and in the confrontation with Abraham. Abraham's nephew Lot has been kidnapped, and Abraham goes and rescues him. And as he's coming back, he meets Melchizedek. And there's things that are specially said about Melchizedek and something that goes on between him and Abraham. First of all, of Melchizedek, it's said in Genesis and in the Psalms that he had no father and no sons. So he doesn't have any beginning, and he doesn't have any procession afterwards. Okay, and therefore, it's a unique priesthood. Again, because he's a high priest, that doesn't say high here, but because he's a king, that's what Melchizedek was. He was both king, and a priest, just like the Messiah. Okay, so there's more of a similitude to Melchizedek than there is to Aaron. Now, because he's a king, if he's also a priest, he's also a high priest. But you know, a couple of verses from here, we're going to make that, you know, the Hebrew writer is going to say that anyway. But notice, he's a priest now appointed forever. That's the prophecy. And that's different than Aaron's high priesthood. Okay. So then, Matthew 5. Thanks, Greg. Okay, verse 7. Okay, in the days of his flesh. Now, this is not after the resurrection. This goes back to his time on earth as a man. More specifically, this is his time in the garden. Okay? Now, at that time, in the days of his flesh, he offered up both prayers. This word prayer here is petitions, pleadings to God. The terminology you won't find in the Gospels, but the words that are used show the emphasis on just how dire a situation he was in. Okay, the word supplication, you find the word supplication, the English word, several times in the New Testament, but the Greek word is only used once here. And it literally means beggings. And this is amplified by, here he is pleading with God, he's begging with God. The gospel says, you know, he's crying, you know, sweating drops of blood. I mean, you can tell the anguish that's going through him. You know, he does this with the loud crying and tears. Now you go, man, this is kind of, he's overwhelmed with this. Well, if you understand the situation, now there's a lot of people probably that went to the cross more stoically, but there's more involved in him. It's not just a crucifixion on the cross. I mean, we know that there's scourgings he has to go through. We know that there's shame he has to go through. We know there's the awesome pain of the crucifixion. But there's more in his experience than there's going to be for any man. Because during this, he has to take on the sins of the world, things that are talked about as abominations to the Father. Things that are going to make him now a curse, Galatians, the third chapter. He's going to become a curse to his own spiritual father. He's going to find a separation that he's never known in his whole eternity of life. And he's not looking forward to it. You know, nobody in his right mind would. And so, you know, he's making an appeal to the one able to save him from death. And a question here, and I can't give you a definite answer, but thanatos, death, can be either physical or spiritual death. Now, what's he praying for? Not to die? Notice it goes, he was heard because of his piety. Was he heard not to die? Didn't he physically die? So, if you look at it from that point of view, God didn't answer his prayer. But we overlook the greater part of the request. And this is what everything hinges on. You know, we can kind of read over this, but you have to get the point. You have to get the point of what's going on here. What was he heard for? Okay. In his piety, in his humility, in his devotion, whatever, what request is he making? Well, notice the two places where you're going to find this. In Matthew the 26th, in the garden, okay, he goes, and he went a little beyond them and fell on his face and prayed, saying, my Father, okay, here's the conditional clause, if it's possible, I mean, he's in his right mind, you know, if we do this some other way, let's go for it. But the unconditional clause is, notice, yet not my will, but thine be done. Okay, what's he praying for? He's praying that God's will be carried out by him. I mean, this is the big danger, is there something in me, you know, that I may not be able to sufficiently, you know, represent you, to not shame you. Notice somewhere else, yeah, where he's talking to his disciples and talking about the trouble, a little bit of a prophecy here, and he goes, now my soul has become troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? He goes, no. It was for this purpose I came to this hour. I'm here for a reason. I'm here for this crucifixion. Because it means more than anybody can even conceive about. His prayer was, Father, glorify thy name. That's what he wanted. More than himself, more than his any wants, he wanted to glorify God. This is what Paul learned when he prayed for, you know, Lord, take away the thorn in the flesh, and goes, you know, my grace is sufficient for you. Okay, if God's glory is through my weakness, give me more weaknesses. And this is what Christ is praying for. Give me, you know, the ability to get through this. Make my obedience total and complete. So that this culminating thing that means so much to the whole world and every soul in it, I pray that I can get through this. Be with me. I mean, he's got to totally humble himself and turn it all over to the Father. Not my will, but thine. Okay. So now, although he was his son, he's the Son of God. Don't you think he's well equipped for this? Well, there's one thing that had to be accomplished. Although he was a son, he learned obedience from the things which he suffered. Total obedience. I mean, it was easy for him to be obedient to his father. I mean, he was an obedient son. But how far will you go? And this is one of the things that the devil saw. This is why there was a temptation in the wilderness. Yeah, I know you're obedient to your father. You're saying all this teachings and stuff. You're doing miracles. But how far will you go to be obedient to your father? And it was the culminating proof that he was a full-blown son, that he was obedient to God as strong as you can get. And this is important. This is a vitally important thing. Because of this, having been made perfect, complete, I mean, this is behind that phrase on the cross, for it is finished. Okay? He's done all he can. You know, he's shown himself to be the obedient son in the most vilest test you could come up with. Okay? Therefore, now notice this. He became then to all those who obey him. Okay? Not just believe in him. There's a lot of people that believe in him, but God is looking for obedience, just as he looked for it in his son. In the son, to qualify to be a proper high priest, he had to be obedient all the way, through all the sufferings. That's the way he qualified himself. That's the way he became perfected, and then sets the standard for the rest of us. Are we obedient? Not just believing. Are we willing, you know, to sit down and look at our lives and go, not my will, but God's be done? Can you look at your life that way? Would you be willing to give up everything for God? That's what he's looking for. Those are the people he's really going to reward. Therefore, he becomes the source then for those who obey him of eternal salvation. Notice this, Hebrews 2, same thing that's said, slightly different. But this is in the context of, what is he trying to do? He's trying to make brethren like himself. He wants to populate heaven with like-minded people. Okay, yet we're all creation of God, but only some are considered God's children, those who are obedient. And this is what Jesus came to do. So, for it was fitting for him, that is God, for whom are all things and through whom are all things. It's, you know, like what Rob talked about, is that everything's God's anyway. Okay? In bringing many sons to glory, this is what Jesus came for, to make people like himself. You know, as dedicated and pious and devoted to God as he was. Now, we're going to fall short, but that's built into the plan. He's looking for people that are going to try, okay, to bring many sons to the glory, the same glory that he, you know, was given, the right hand, to perfect the author of their salvation through sufferings. Okay? This is why God tells us all those who follow God are going to suffer. It's part of the plan. Now, it's the test for you, for all of us. You know, are we really here for God or for ourselves? The rest of this then, therefore he's being designated by God. Okay, he earned it. As a high priest, according to the order of Melchizedek. So this is how Christ became a high priest. There's no high priest that's ever went through this kind of trial. This is what sets him up and above every high priest that ever was. This is why his order of Melchizedek is far greater than that of the Aaronic priesthood. Now, there's something here I want to put in the invitation. Yeah? But I'm going to say a little bit more, you know, what the Hebrew writer is getting into before we get to it. First of all, then, now, concerning him, that is Melchizedek. You know, there's more in chapter 7 about Melchizedek. You know, as he gets into another proof how Melchizedek was a greater high priest than Aaron was, because Abraham bowed down to Melchizedek, and then you get this box in a box in a box theory, because in the loins of Abraham was the seed of Aaron. So when Abraham pays homage or you know, receives blessings from Melchizedek, then so did Aaron. And the conclusion is the greater always blesses the lesser. So the greater Abraham was blessing the lesser, the greater Melchizedek was blessing the lesser Abraham, which means the lesser also was Aaron. So the high priesthood is a lot greater. Okay? Now concerning him, we have much to say or discuss, logos. Okay? And there's, you know, but it's hard to explain. Why is it hard to explain? I mean, the Hebrew writer really wants to get into this, but he says, you've become dull of hearing. Now, this is one of the things that becomes a warning for the rest of us. How do we become dull of hearing? Yeah. One of the things that kind of pops to mind as an example is you get you know young people in junior high, they seem very enthusiastic about the things of God and want to be you know, involved in it. And then they get into high school. Yeah. And I don't know if there's something kind of an arrogance that goes with the senior year, or we'll just call it a lot of diversions, a lot of peer pressure, a lot of exciting things going on in the world. And so they don't think about, you know, they don't want to think about spiritual things. You know, so they sit maybe on the back row, and they got their buddy there, and they're discussing things with one another, or their mind's on something, you know some girl or whatever. Or you know somebody in the world that's going on that they want to get back to, they really don't listen much. Now, once I know this because I was a teenager one time, and that's what went through my mind, virtually nothing. A lot of older folks get in the same predicament. You know, where there's things in the world that occupy us, you know, that we find that they're more important than the things you can learn in church. Yeah. It's been bred into us. You know, it's always, you know, I have to stay home for do my secular homework and not come Wednesday night for church. We become dull of hearing. We put the things of God as being less important. And we just don't want to listen to it, whatever. You know, the Hebrew writers were, or the Hebrews were that, the Hebrew Christians were the same way. Especially since there was something, as far as they were concerned, more important than that was the persecution that was going on. For a while, Christianity was a lawful religion, and now it wasn't lawful anymore. But Judaism was. So for these Jewish Christians, it was easy for them, well, why don't we go back to Judaism? And this is where their mind was and why they were thinking about it. They didn't want to hear about a new priesthood and all this kind of stuff. You know, they go, well, you know, let's go back and refresh ourselves with our Judaism because we're protected under that. And the writer here is going, man, there's so much more important things. I mean, if you think about it, you know, it's, yeah, you can't look at this as just, you know, religious stuff, you know, and, you know, we have our Bibles and we kind of bring them and we sit on them and whatever. And then we take them home and we put them on the shelf, you know, and it's kind of out of our lives. But what you're learning now is the most important thing in your life. It is, seriously. it is the most important thing in your life because it's something that goes beyond this life. We'll get back to that too. But we ask ourselves, have we become dull of hearing? For though by this time, they should have been teachers, should know enough about this stuff that they could teach others. How many of us, we've been in the church 30, 40, 50 years, sit on the back seat, and if you ask them, can you tell, what's necessary in order to be saved? And you couldn't quote one verse. By this time, you ought to be teachers, but you have need for someone to teach you the first principles or rudimentary principles or elements of the oracles of God. Now, oracles, another way to go with this, but primarily this is a different word than we're usually used to. We think of the logos, the word of God, but this is the rhema. This is the utterance. This is the spoken word. Logos can be the scriptures that can be represented in whatever, but the rhema is the word that comes out of God's mouth. With this, we can distort it. We can twist it. In fact, Peter warns us against not doing that. But what comes out of God's mouth is pure and undistorted. And this is when we study this, that's what we're trying to get back to. In fact, you have two examples of this in this context. What did he say in Psalms 2? What did he say in Psalms 110? That came right out of God's mouth. He said this. And this is why the author goes back to those. Now, can we do that? We should, after a period of time, be well-versed in the scriptures that we can teach. And we shouldn't have to sit here for years and years and years and just be getting, elementary principles. What do we mean by that? Rudimentary elements, this is what the word stoicheia means. First principles, row, rank. I mean, it just talks about, kind of the building things, the beginning parts of something that you're building. Okay, it could be a battle line. As you get soldiers together, I remember when I was in the service, we're sitting there, marching in parade, for like 2 or 3 hours at a time. Everybody's going, well, what are we doing this? Just give me your rifle and show me how to kill something. Because you got to learn the discipline first. You got to be able to follow orders and everybody be going the same direction. That's the rank and file. Later, you learn, what you do when you actually get into a battle. Okay, as you look at a building, these things are columns in line. Those are the beginning structures. There's a lot like the Parthenon that's just got the columns. It's back to just the beginning structures. It's not really a temple. If it doesn't have a roof on it, the columns are there for nothing. Okay, and once you get the roof on, you got to put stuff in the temple to make it a temple. Other than that, it's just a box. The Hebrew writer says, we ain't got that far yet. We still got to go back to the beginning structures here and start rebuilding until you get to a point. In fact, probably the best example of this, for everyone who takes only of milk is not accustomed to the word of righteousness, he's a babe. Okay? The word of righteousness, are you willing to, logos here, discuss right things? No. I mean, a child is not ready to do that. A child, according to 1 Corinthians 13:11, when I was a child, Paul said, I used to speak as a child, think as a child, reason as a child. How much reasoning does a child have? I mean, up until high school, almost in a college, most students are just fed stuff, which they're taught to recall or regurgitate. I mean, they almost look at it as, an affront. Now you're going to ask me to think? Now I got all this stuff in my head, I got to start putting it together and reason it and come up with a conclusion? Yeah. But the Hebrews were getting away from that ability. They're getting away from it. They were thinking like children, no reasoning at all. It's interesting listening to some of the children here. They're just like 2 years old and they've learned words. And they come up, first of all, they're quiet for like a year. And then all of a sudden they start learning stuff and it comes out in its words, but it's not hooked together right. It's just a lot of gibberish. And sometimes our Our religion can be the same way. Our devotion to God can be just gibberish. We learn buzzwords and stuff like that, and we know things like pray and sing and all this kind of, but we actually know how to think these things through. I mean, a lot of what Paul does and the apostles do is they take some of the sayings of God and they expound upon them. They take them to natural conclusions. They don't tell us anything different, but they do make proper applications to certain things. And this is what we're required to do. You know, no longer being just children sitting there regurgitating whatever. Come on. Solid food is for the mature. If you want to get into meatier things, okay, you're going to have to grow to the task. You're going to have find the Word of God in you complete, who because of practice of their senses or their faculties, okay, they've trained them to use them properly, okay, so that they can discern good and evil. Translation is a little harsh here. Okay, it's not really porneos for evil, whatever. This is kind of a little play on words, the kalos versus the kakos. The more excellent things versus the baser things. And this is what the Hebrew writer is trying to get them to do. Okay, look at the two systems. Look at what you have as Christ as our high priest and what you have as just Aaron as our high priest. Which is the better? Which is the more beneficial? Which is the one that will really get you into heaven? And which one, the other one is just a shadow of the substance? We have to know these things. If you're visiting with us, we appreciate your presence. We got a good crowd of not so familiar faces here. Yeah, some from the past and some from recent past. We very much appreciate your presence here. We're encouraged by your desire to come and worship God and to study, you know, from God's Word. And we hope and pray that what we've done this morning is beneficial to you. If you've got any questions, let us know. We ask you to linger a little afterwards so we can get to know you better. Especially me. Yeah. I'm working on the names, but boy, like I told one lady this morning, I didn't realize who they were until they got, yeah, the husband and wife were together. Yeah, and then I can know them. Okay. Okay. Last part of the invitation, though. Okay. Something we have to carry away from this, which is a good argument, you know, for our position as the Church of Christ. My wife and I know someone who is a Catholic. And they just figure this is their logic, baseline logic, is that because it's the oldest church, it's got to be right. Well, the logic's kind of good, but the facts are wrong. Okay. The church, the Catholic Church established itself from a long lineage of popes. Now, the word pope, if you're not familiar with it, is the Latin word for papa. Means father. Okay. The very thing that Jesus told his disciples, don't call anyone your father, your spiritual father. There's only one, that's God in heaven. Okay. And then they go, well, from Peter then, the first pope, we've got this lineage that's lasted up to present time. Well, they don't. If you start looking at their list, they get kind of confused right after Peter. And there's times when they had no popes, which interrupted, you know, the lineage. There's time they had three popes, you know, which kind of got confusing. It doesn't have to do with popes. It doesn't have to do with lineage. What did we just get through looking at? A high priest that doesn't have a lineage. What we have from the first century is a high priest like no other. We have a high priest that doesn't have just the honor of a high priest. We have one that's been glorified and sits on the right hand of God. We have one who's a high priest in perpetuity. From the first century, he has resided and makes intercession for us. He understands our sympathies better than anyone, and he's able to put things in the Father's ear on our behalf. So any church that's organized properly, that goes by God's word, you know, and has Christ as the high priest and head of it, is the oldest church on the planet. And our high priest has been there since the first century. And we need to refer to him. We need to go to him. In fact, we, as it was mentioned this morning, we as priests, 1 Peter, the second chapter, we're priests. Who do we go to? We have direct access to Christ, the Son of God, who is our high priest. And from that, all blessings flow. If there's anything we can do for you to get you within that relationship, you know, if you need to know more, I'd be happy to sit down with you. If you'd like to make, you know, the commitment to confessing Christ as your Lord, for, you know, to start thinking about, you know, changing your life in service to Him, to be truly obedient to God, because that's the difference, putting His will first, entering the waters of baptism. We can accomplish this very hour, have your sins washed away, and you can be pure before God and innocent and begin a life of service to Him. Of course, if you've already started that, you need perhaps prayers of the congregation. We can do that also. Please let us know whatever your needs are as we stand to sing.